Hi there, this is Dan Jones and this is my podcast. I'm a researcher, an oceanographer to be more specific, and on this podcast I have conversations with other scientists whose work intersects with climate science in some way. And I mean that in a pretty broad sense. I mean, I could talk to oceanographers, I could talk to atmospheric scientists, chemists, geologists. I could even, really under that broad umbrella, I could talk with folks whose work impacts on policy and things as well. So really, it's meant to be pretty broad. The conversations are pretty long format. They're casual. They are meant to be kind of conversational. And I totally stole that format from many of the podcasts that I've been listening to over the years. Yeah, so the introduction, I'm going to try the rambling style introduction again for a few minutes, maybe about five to 10 minutes or so. So if you don't want to hear me go on and on, do feel free to skip ahead. I'll give you a little preview though. I've decided I'm going to tell the story of the time that Trevor McDougall threatened to castrate me. So if you give me a minute, I'll spell that out for you. I had a great conversation with Andrew Myers. I'm recording this intro just a couple hours after our conversation, so that way everything is still fresh in my mind. Andrew and I have worked together at the British Antarctic Survey for many years now. 4.5 years. So that's a huge amount of time. And I've always liked working with him. He's a really smart, chill person. He's calm. We talk about this some in the interview, about how he's another one of those really calm people. And I need those kind of people in my life. I can be way too high strung and way too anxious about things. So it's really beneficial for me to surround myself with calm people who can absorb some of my anxiety. not that that's their problem. That shouldn't be, you know, I don't want to put that on the people around me, but it just helps if you've got those people who can act as dampers, who can absorb some of my tendency to be anxious. So Andrew, he grew up in Hobart, Australia, went to the University of Tasmania, spent most of his life down there, and a few years ago moved to the UK, moved to somewhat sunny Cambridge. We have a talk about his transition from Hobart to Bass, his pathway through science and what that's been like for him. He's also led numerous research cruises, so we talk about that. We talk about writing and creativity and all of the usual things that I like to talk about on the podcast. He also draws. He does these beautiful Calvin and Hobbes style cartoons. I don't know if he's shared them publicly, to be honest, but I've seen some of them. They're really good. They're really nice. So that's one of his creative outlets, these nice Calvin and Hobbes style drawings. He also says he was in a barbershop quartet, and I haven't looked that up. He says there might be a YouTube video somewhere, so maybe somebody wants to find it and let me know where it is, and that should be good fun. Andrew's great to work with, really smart. We also talk about machine learning a bit, although the focus of this podcast isn't typically on the science itself. It's fun to talk about some specific science applications like that. So I'm glad we did. That was a good chat. Right, so Trevor McDougall. So Trevor McDougall, if you don't know, he's a somewhat legendary oceanographer who works in Australia. He's one of these big theoretical figures who's made some really nice contributions to the field over the years. He's responsible for the TEOS 10 toolbox, which is the thermodynamic equations of seawater. He sometimes refers to himself as the god of thermodynamics. To be fair, I don't know if he's referred to himself in that way, but the TEOS 10 email that is partly his responsibility, from what I understand, is God at TEOS 10. So yeah, that's how he It's obviously, if you know him, it's a joke. He's a good-natured person. And this is, meant to be kind of lighthearted. Yeah, so Trevor, he threatened to castrate me and threatened to castrate all of my co-authors on a paper that we wrote a couple of years ago. So let me tell you the story. So in one of the introductory figures of this paper, it was not a results figure. It wasn't a figure. Nothing relied on this figure. So that's kind of good in a way, and you'll see why in just a minute. I was plotting a quantity that had been projected onto a certain choice of density surface. I won't go into all the gory details here, but basically, I had made a choice that Trevor didn't think was correct. I had chosen a certain combination of a stream function, which tells you about circulation and density, that he thought, no, you can't do that. That's not physically correct. And hey, he's the guy. It doesn't have to be a guy, but he's the person. He's the person who knows about, he's one of the certainly the world experts about what density surfaces should you use when using different stream functions. So the paper came out, and I thought I had done it correctly. We had read the website. We had read the descriptions on his website about how all this stuff works. And yeah, we thought we had done it appropriately. Apparently, we had chosen the wrong density surface stream function combination. And so Trevor sent this email saying, "Well, we have noticed you have committed the crime of using the wrong density surface stream function combination. And therefore, as a result, we will castrate you. We will send Andreas Klocker, his enforcer, Trevor's enforcer, to come castrate you in Cambridge, including all of your co-authors." So, yeah, that was interesting. I didn't really know how to take that. I didn't know Trevor, so I didn't really know how to take that. And I went to Andrew, and Andrew included me on in the kind of spirit of this email. He's like, "Ah, okay. Let me tell you. Let Andrew explained it to me. He sorted it out. He put me in the right mental framework to understand this joke." So at least I think it's a joke. It hasn't happened yet. I'm going to live the rest of my life in terror, running away from Trevor McDougal, finding any little hiding place I can to stay away from his blades or whatever it is he's got lurking in his back pocket. Yeah, I guess it's him and Andreas. I guess I'm just gonna have to avoid them forever. But anyway, so Trevor did visit Cambridge not too long ago, and I brought it up, and well, we had a good laugh over it. He still says he's gonna do it. He still says this is gonna happen someday. So I guess I'm just waiting. It's just hanging over my head. But anyway, yeah, he's a smart guy, good guy. But yeah, let me get to the conversation with Andrew as quickly as we can, because I really enjoyed it, and I hope that you do as well. There's a lot of good advice in there for students and for people, early career folks like myself, and people who are putting it together, and people who are trying to figure out their path. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast, was to give us an opportunity to have those conversations about finding your pathway from your early life into some kind of expression of science, however that ends up. But I'm rambling, as I warned you. I don't feel too bad for rambling, because I did tell you. I'm like, I'm gonna ramble. This is gonna happen. But yeah, okay. So let's go ahead and get into the conversation with Andrew Myers. Let's try it again. Andrew Myers, British Antarctic Survey. Really good conversation.
Hello.
Here we go.
Excellent. Audio close up.
This is cool.
This is the deal. This is the setup.
Where did this come from?
Well, they're called Blue is the brand name. And it's a Blue Snowball microphone. So Steph got them for me, basically. Over Christmas, as a way to like enable me and encourage me to like, yeah, go ahead and do it. I'd been talking about doing it for so long that she kind of got these to say like, yeah,
Just go ahead. Go ahead and do it. Go ahead and try it. So it's been going all right, and I just plug them up to the laptop there, and then sit down with somebody, and I basically start for conversation, and I can't go out to the pub like a normal person, so I just turn it into a work thing.
Okay.
Right? I might be kidding, maybe.
What's the general format? How does this work? Is this sort of...
Just talk, yeah.
Is it edited afterwards, or is it all just a,
no.
just a rolling conversation?
It's all just rolling, yeah. It just goes. It's not edited at all.
Okay.
It's like this long format thing. I basically stole that same kind of format from a lot of other podcasts where we just capture pretty much the whole thing. I mean, obviously, if there's a part that, you know, either of us feels like, actually, let's really not put that out there.
Sure, talk about that, yeah.
Then that's fine. We can cut that out. But that doesn't usually happen very often.
No, okay.
I don't know. So, I don't know. How you doing? How's the morning going?
Pretty well. I've just managed dropped Hugo off at nursery, said his goodbyes, and tidied up the house and came straight in.
Yeah.
So I've made it in extra early, so before 10 o'clock for me. It's great.
Nice. I want to acknowledge the weirdness that, like, so we work together a lot, and so we've sat in this particular arrangement a lot and talked about science a lot.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of, I thought about maybe trying a different venue, but I don't know, this is fine. We'll just...
I have to put the idea of thousands and thousands of people sitting in this office with us out of my head. And just pretend we're here, staring at that whiteboard.
tens of people.
Which is suspiciously quite clean differential equations at the moment.
Yeah, so I cleaned it yesterday because I kind of felt self-conscious about... I had a bunch of equations up there for a long time, and I felt like I have an office mate, right? And I felt like I'd taken the whole whiteboard over, and that there wasn't any space for my office mate to write anything that she might want to write on there. So I wrote down everything I wanted and then, you know, kind of erased it. Yeah.
I think legacy whiteboards are important. I've got one in my office that dates back to about 2014. And it's still got all the cabin allocations from the first voyage I led. So I put everyone's names and put them in cabins, and it hasn't moved since.
So those markings are permanent now. Those are like dug into the board.
They're burnt into the board.
Yeah, they're not going to come out. All the little marker particles are firmly wedged into the board itself.
Yeah.
I don't know. So I did kind of think about that. I'm like, well, we're so used to like sitting in this spot. And don't worry, it's not thousands of people. It's tens of people.
Oh, well, not yet.
You mean like if it just stays on the internet forever?
Yeah, eventually... people in the back... You know, once you reach world fame, people will be searching through your back catalogue material.
Yeah, that's right. Oh, so some person, you know, a few decades from now...
That's right, yeah.
...will
stumble across this.
Who was it? Andrew Myers, anyway. What was he really like? Yeah, I don't know. Is that bothering you? You think is it stressing?
No.
You know,
no, I just needed to settle down into the idea of, oh, this has actually started.
Yeah, no, that's right. It's not meant to like. That's another thing that I kind of stole from that long format podcast. That the long format is just like it just starts, and it includes all the, you know, people coming in and having this initial kind of shuffling, and that way it's not like formal. There's no formal. I talk about this a lot, where there's no formal moment where it, like, starts.
Yeah, okay. I feel like we're in a meta-podcast now. We're talking about making of the podcast that we're currently making.
Yeah, I do that a lot. I talk about the thing I'm doing, which is... I don't know if that's helpful or not. But I looked at your profile page, and you put a lot on there, so that was pretty helpful. So thanks for... You made... You know, I don't like do a ton of research beforehand, necessarily, but I like to at least have a little glance around to get my thoughts organized a little bit.
Yeah, I figured I don't actually have any web presence, so I should probably make sure my BASC profile page is at least somewhat complete.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you're not doing the Twitter thing, and what else is there? I guess there's the you could have some scientists have like their own web page.
I mean, I could have my own web page, but I never really felt the need.
Yeah, that would just be another thing to like keep up with and to fuss with.
That's right. Yeah, and to look bad when it's 10 years out of date. And still in GeoCities.
Yeah, GeoCities. Or it has frames. It has frames from the 90s. Or it has like, your most recent publication is 2007 or something like that.
So,
you can stumble across those. Yeah, so we've talked a lot. And I wanted to, you know, acknowledge that just to get that idea out there that I think it could be slightly awkward for us to like, you know, you've told me some of these things before. But there's a little bit, there's an audience, right? There's folks who will, you know, listen to it. So
So I know you grew up in Hobart,
mm-hmm.
Australia. What's the? I know you had a big family, right? You had lots of brothers.
Yeah, fairly big. I mean, Hobart's one of those places. It's at the far end of the earth, and at least when I was growing up, people who grew up there often stayed there. It wasn't particularly easy to get to the rest of Australia or the mainland, as we called it. So there was a bit of an island mentality. Tasmania is pretty big. Like, I think geographically it's about the size of the Netherlands, but there's only about 500,000 people there.
Yeah.
And so it was at least quite isolated. It was quite expensive to get flights out, and getting the ferry was, you know, a big deal. So anyone who went to the mainland when I was growing up was, you know, oh, you went to the mainland. Very exciting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you need to go on.
That was going to the big city, huh?
Yeah,
that
was going to the big city, and you got to see real football played by the players that you saw on television. So yeah, Hobart was a fairly isolated place.
I think probably a lot of people can sympathize with that, because even though I didn't grow up on an island, like, we were far enough away from anything, any big cities, that, you know, it was a big deal to drive an hour and a half to Savannah even, and or drive a couple hours to Atlanta. That was like a... Wow, that was a big accomplishment or a big event.
Yeah, and it was before the era of these cheap flights where you could, like, legitimately go just to a place overnight or even for a day on a plane, which just didn't happen when I was growing up.
Yeah. So your folks were teachers, or are teachers? Or are they still doing it?
No, they're both retired now. Both retired? Happily spending my inheritance.
That's their job.
Yeah, so I have to say, growing up, so my mum didn't work. I was the oldest of four, and my mum didn't work. While we were all growing, getting into our school age, and my dad was a teacher. But once my younger sister got into school, then mum sort of took her career right off and became a bit of a star in the, you know, in the public teaching space. It was really heavily, because she had a training in computer science, which was pretty unusual for a woman, particularly back in, I guess she did her undergraduates in the 70s.
Mm.
So, you know, she learned on punch card computers and that sort of thing. So when she came back and did her teaching degree and then got into teaching space, she became, really motivated to press forward with new educational ideas, like using games and programming in the classroom, which was pretty new at the time. Having two teachers as parents was good. I didn't realise it at the time, but it meant your family was always home, everyone together, for all the holidays and things, so we could always go out and do stuff.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, which is something I'm realising now that I have a son, that I feel bad that the work hours, the work holidays certainly don't line up with the school holidays.
Not necessarily, right? You can take some time off, but it doesn't overlap. There's no natural, like, break or time when, okay, you're not working for this period, or not working in a classroom every day. I know, you know, I was not a high school teacher, but I was a teacher for a while, and I know you do plenty of work over those breaks. It's just a different mode.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, prep work or, you know... It's stuff that's more time flexible. You might not have to be, like, in a building, but you are working sometimes over those breaks.
And as a kid, it meant you could be at home, or your parents were at home. They might be working, they might be doing marking or doing lesson prep, but they're still home.
Yeah.
And so that was something that was really nice, and sort of was really, you know, we had quite a close family.
Did they, were they really supportive of your kind of direction towards science? Or
yeah, well, absolutely. Probably a little bit too much. I remember being discouraged from... We had a lawnmower which had broken down and was old, and I wanted to take it apart. And I was actively discouraged from doing that because they didn't want me to suddenly get a love for auto mechanics and end up as a grease monkey.
Not that there's anything wrong with that. But...
no, I mean, I couldn't see what the problem was, and I still don't. But I think I sort of settled into quite an academic... quite an academic achiever, I guess, in early high school, and then I sort of stayed there. I think they were quite keen to push that.
Yeah.
I guess because they were teachers, they'd seen what can happen to kids who either become obsessed with something that maybe isn't a career, or just, like, drop out to go surfing. And so they obviously sort of latched onto the worst case scenario and said, no, don't pull that lawnmower apart. A similar thing happened with surfing. I don't want to make my parents seem like monsters. They were amazing and they were very supportive. But I remember being told that I couldn't go surfing, or couldn't spend all my time learning to surf, because my mum worked at a school that was near the beach, and she always knew when the points were going because half the kids wouldn't turn up in the morning.
Oh, right.
And so I was sort of discouraged from doing that and becoming a surfer bum.
So she saw that pathway of, like, if you get sucked up into that...
Yeah, into that lifestyle, and, you know, school falls away and your grades suffer and, you know, your life goes down the drain. It was her fear. But little did I know that, you know, when I got a real job and was working at CSIRO, the Australian... Commonwealth Institute for... No, I can't even do this anymore.
It's okay, somebody will...
Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organisation, or as Trevor McDougall likes to call it, Cheap Research in the Rural... No, Cheap Research in the Rural Outback? Yes. Cheap.
What's the S?
Yes.
Cheap Science?
Cheap Science in the Rural Outback.
Cheap Science in the... Oh, dear. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, when I started working there...
That's Trevor McDougall. That's not us. We didn't say that.
Yeah, but yeah, that's old Trevor.
Yeah,
when I started working there, I'd find out that people would come in dripping wet at like 11 o'clock in the morning because they'd been out surfing because the points were going.
Yeah.
And, you know, serious scientists.
They do that same thing at Scripps in San Diego. People have, you know, surfboards in their offices, and at lunch they'll just go out and surf for a little while. I guess eat a sandwich or something at some point, or not, unless they're... So you realize it could be maybe a part of your,
life. I'd missed my little window of learning how to balance properly on a surfboard. I was too old by that stage.
Oh. Four brothers or three brothers?
Four kids.
Four kids.
I was the eldest, two brothers and two sisters.
Okay. What are they up to?
So my brother, he is now works, so they're all in Hobart still. My brother lived and worked for several years in Melbourne, but eventually came back to the motherland. So he works for the Tasmanian government, basically working as a... he works in GIS, so mapping, and has a lot to do with emergency response. So Tasmania and Australia in general suffers from a lot of bushfires. And so getting emergency teams in the right place, working out where you can let fires burn to encourage them to move away from settlements and to make plans for the future when fires will come through, requires a lot of mapping.
Yeah.
And so he works with emergency services for both mapping and their preparations. And he can do all sorts of other interesting things. I think we had a visit from Prince Charles, and he had to spend a lot of time mapping out potential sniper points. So, yeah, interesting variety. It's a cool job.
That's the sort of stuff the Secret Service would be very interested in, is some technology that would enable you to kind of do that. So that was one of your brothers,
that's
right?
Yeah, that was my brother.
Your brother. That's right, because it's two boys, two girls.
Two girls.
Yeah, okay.
So my eldest sister, she's now a teacher, actually at the same high school my mum finished teaching at. But she, before that, before she became a teacher, she was a bush guide. So Tasmania is a beautiful wilderness with lots of mountains and beaches.
Yeah.
Sort of, you can think of it as like New Zealand light. and so walking is a big industry there.
Yeah.
And so she was a tour guide, a walking guide for, you'd say, pretty upmarket walkers. And so she did a lot of carrying and cooking and cleaning, and also living in the bush and taking people through this beautiful space.
Yeah, people who didn't mind paying a little. I guess they probably pay a little bit more.
Say they paid a little bit, yeah.
What's her subject? What kind of stuff does she teach?
She's a primary school teacher, so they potentially can do anything.
Yeah.
But she does science mostly now.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah.
And I think you said your mom was doing computer science, and your dad, what was he?
My dad was a primary school teacher.
Also.
They don't have a lot of... Well, they have to teach everything, don't they?
Yeah.
They don't really have a specialty. He ended up as a principal, actually.
They have that's a very specific skill set, isn't it? Like being able to teach really young kids.
Yeah.
That's something like I said, I taught some university. That's a different universe. That's like a whole different world than teaching kids.
Oh, yeah,
you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. At university, you do not need the skill to be able to teach, whereas in high school and primary school, you're actually expected to be able to educate people.
That's right.
Yeah.
And, you know, when they're really little, you'd have, like, you know, lots of emotional management and expectation management and classroom control. And you also need to be able to boil everything down into a really simple form that still has some real content in there, that still has some real meat to it, but that has been distilled to its essence. So it's a really special skill set.
And absolutely, and having two parents as teachers, really, like our family really had a good appreciation of how important education is to everyone, really, and how it can really sort of elevate anyone. The importance of a really solid public school system.
Yeah.
So that my parents are both really strong advocates of that as well, because they always worked in public schools. And Tasmania had an extremely good public school system.
Right. It helps the whole, like, society, like, everywhere where you live.
Yeah, absolutely.
Why would you not support that? Like, it helps your, you know, the place where you live.
Yeah.
Like, the people around you.
And it really meant that anyone can do anything. You weren't trapped in a certain life. And having access to good primary education and affordable university education was something I really benefited from.
Yeah. So you went to the University of Tasmania, and that's also... Is that also in Hobart, or is that somewhere else on the island?
It's also in Hobart, yeah. So okay. I growing up in Hobart meant that I was quite attached to the place. I mean, I think as... Particularly when I was younger, Hobart had a bad reputation for teenagers as not having much to do, which is completely wrong. It had tons of stuff to do, particularly if you like being outside, but... You know, teenagers, it didn't have a huge club scene or anything like that. So the sort of things that teenagers often think they like, they didn't offer a lot of.
It's funny, they think they like, and for some teenagers, you try it out and you go,
yeah,
that's it?
It's
a bunch of sweaty people in a loud room.
Yeah.
So
it's not, absolutely not the case anymore. Hobart's become a real culture capital.
Yeah.
So much so that I worry that I may be, if I ever want to go back, it might be completely priced out.
Oh. You can't go home. You're priced out. Although we live in Cambridge, so we can't talk too much about that. Yeah.
No, it always. Well, I guess I'm just a little sad because it always felt like a place that didn't. It was called sort of nicknamed Slobart when I was young, and it was because it didn't change very much.
Yeah.
And it was always sort of happy in the back of my mind that if working elsewhere in the world and this sort of globetrotting lifestyle that science sometimes encourage, if that ever didn't work out, we could go back to Hobart and it would all be the same. It's not. You can't go home.
Maybe not. Yeah, yeah. I've read over the years some. This is a little bit more general than that, but I read since moving to the UK, that repatriation can be really difficult and sometimes harder than expatriation, than like leaving country where you grew up. Like coming back to it can actually be harder because of what you mentioned. That place has changed since you've been away. And you come back and everything's a little different and everything, nothing quite feels like it's where you remember it to be.
And particularly if you come back to the same place and the same people, those people have moved on, their lives have changed, they have different interests, different friendship groups and things like that. So I think you just, it can be a happy little idea in your head, but I think being realistic about it, you can paint it a bit too rosily.
Yeah. So it was physics, right?
Undergrad. I guess what I was trying to say there overall was that I wasn't really ready to leave Hobart.
Right.
I really liked it.
Yeah.
So a lot of people do leave and go to other universities around Australia or overseas, but I was pretty happy just going to the University of Tasmania, which also meant I could continue living at home and bumming off my parents. I did undergraduate mathematics and physics. It ended up being a double major, so it just meant 50% maths, 50% physics.
Yeah. Sorry, excuse me. And then in Australia, is it more like the UK where you're just studying that subject, or do you have broad classes as well?
You can choose. If you want, you can have broad classes, and certainly some degrees encourage it. Like, I think if you're doing law, you're encouraged to do several art-style classes, at least in the first year or two.
Okay, yeah.
I could be wrong, but I seem to recall that. But for mathematics and physics, I took that and some computer science classes. Because I was quite academically inclined, I went to the university the year before to talk to some of the professors about what might be sensible classes to choose. And I remember one, I don't want to say rusted on, but he'd been there for a while. He worked in the maths department and he insisted that there was no need at all to do computer science.
It's a passing fad.
Yeah, that's right. This coding business is completely unnecessary. So I'm glad I didn't listen to him, and I did several classes in learning how to code.
What's our version of that going to be when we're old people?
Oh.
Are we going to go like, you don't have to get the chip in your head. Just you don't have to have it implanted.
Yeah,
just
infused with the core mind. Yeah.
Just skip that. It's just a passing fad. It's completely unnecessary. Yeah, so that was your undergrad and your PhD, right? You continued?
Yeah, that's right. So by that stage, actually during college, which is the Tasmanian version of years 11 and 12, when you're like 16, 17, I met my current wife. She was an engineer. So she was the year ahead of me, but we had a couple of classes in university together. And I tended to hang out with the engineers a lot more than the maths and physics guys, mostly because they were a lot more fun. So I had much more drinking with the engineers. Yeah, they knew how to have a good time. And so I mostly associated with them outside my classes. But
how did you meet? What was the
that
was the group you were hanging out with?
That was pretty much the group I was hanging out with. So my high school was all boys and her high school was all girls. So by the time we got put together into this college, which was a different school, and it's really nice actually. The colleges there, they're like a little university. You don't wear uniforms anymore, which everyone does in high school in Australia. You're encouraged to call their teachers by the first name. Attendance is still mandatory, but certainly more flexible. You're allowed off campus. So you're treated much more like an adult in a little university. And so we both had just encountered the opposite sex for the first time in the last 4 years. And so none of us knew how to talk to each other. But it was also the era of house parties and your first introduction to alcohol and things like that. So it was a really fun time.
That's how you talk.
Yeah. I don't encourage that.
Yeah.
That's how it worked. We met there and we've stayed together ever since. But it also meant that end of my undergraduate degree, I really didn't want to move away at that point.
Right, yeah.
Because my wife, Alison, had just landed a good job at a pulp and paper mill as a mechatronic engineer or a control systems engineer. And so I wasn't really ready to move on. So I did my honours in Hobart. What I did was look around for what Hobart was particularly good at in science.
So oceanography wasn't yet on the radar, right? It sounds like you were...
During my undergraduate, I didn't even do a fluids course simply because it wasn't actually offered in the year. It was offered every second year. Oceanography wasn't really on my radar until I started looking around in my fourth year, which is honours, where you basically take on a project. And that at that point, you sort of get more entrenched into a certain subject. And I wanted to... Yeah, so I looked around at what Hobart was good at and I discovered we had some very good astrophysicists and particularly radio astronomers.
Mm.
And we also were host to CSIRO, Marine and Atmospheres, and the Australian Antarctic Division, and a couple of other smaller institutes which are all focused on marine science. Hobart has a massively high proportion of marine scientists, which is not something I really realised when growing up, but when I started looking around, that became apparent.
Right, it seems normal wherever you grow up, you think, oh, I guess every town has
a bunch of scientists and icebreakers parked in the harbour. That was just what happened.
Imagine the people growing up in Woods Hole. They don't know. They don't know the 10 people growing up in Woods Hole. So that's cool. And I guess you say you found out. So there were a lot of options, right? Those options started to become apparent that was something that was going on in Hobart.
Yeah.
So you started to...
And by university, I realized that I really wanted to be a scientist. And I knew to do that, I would have to get a PhD. And so coming out of undergrad, a lot of people, and particularly in maths and physics, are looking around for what they might do. And often they go off and become accountants or consultants or, you know, something similarly numeric, but not particularly scientific.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that, so I knew I had to go on.
Mm.
And I looked around and there was a new honors course that had only been offered the year before. And so we were coming into the second year, I think. with IASOS, the Institute for Antarctic and Southern Ocean Studies.
Mm.
I got that acronym right.
Nice.
And that was part of the university, but it was also it had offered teaching, but also had a lot of researchers associated with it.
Yeah.
And so I scoured around and I met my supervisor there, who was Nathan Bendoff, who I ended up doing my PhD with, as an excellent sort of international class oceanographer. Very interesting character, sort of cackled a lot.
cackled.
He had a very distinctive laugh. You could hear him coming. So if you wanted to hide or wanted to catch him, you could always have a bit of a heads up.
Yeah? What was he like as an advisor? Was he more hands-off or more involved?
Nathan is really dedicated to his science, not so much on his admin.
Okay, yeah.
So he could be a little bit scattered and sometimes hard to nail down. He was always sort of rushing off to the next meeting, which he was late for. But at the same time, he was late because he gave all the time necessary for science.
Yeah.
And so when I managed to find him for meetings, I got as much time as necessary. So I used to just take to bursting into his office and waving around figures and then we just sit down and talk about those figures for sometimes several hours.
So that was his priority. He was like, that's priority number one.
That's right, yeah. Maybe. Science was priority number one, and I'm pretty sure it still is, because when I go back and visit Hobart, I do the same thing. I burst into his office, and then we end up talking about stuff until whoever he was supposed to meet next comes looking for him.
Was he the guy who... You were telling me about somebody you worked with who had like a... in the morning, like a window where that was science only... And that was the only thing.
No, that was Trevor.
That's Trevor. Okay. Yeah.
I have to say, I think it's a characteristic of scientists that they really love doing science, and as they get more senior, they inevitably get more admin things like grants, stuff that, you know, facilitates science and is important, but
yeah.
isn't really science, and they sort of resent that somewhat and make time for science over it.
And that that shift is happening to you now a bit, I guess.
Absolutely. Sort of really does sneak up on you. At first, you feel quite. You feel quite proud that someone's asking you to do these sorts of important things like write grants or lead groups, and then you realize that, I'm doing less science.
Yeah. What's happening? Yeah. Why haven't I written anything in a while?
That's it.
Because you're running off to meetings and you're... Yeah, it's hard. I guess you have to put up some walls and you have to get good at saying no. And that's a skill you have to develop somehow. How to say no, or how to delegate, you know, how to put stuff...
And also, like, decide what's acceptable standards as well. Because often with science, you're really, you know, science is very rigorous, and you want to, and you know you're going to go, your peers will be scrutinizing your work very closely.
Yeah, you feel them hovering over your shoulder.
And you want to do the best you possibly can. Also because, you know, the idea of science is moving humanity forward in a very broad sense. And, you know,
hopefully.
But you want to get it right, right?
Yeah.
You know, this is your contribution to society, and so you want to do a nice job. Admin doesn't necessarily need to be done at the same level, but once you've got used to that sort of putting that level of work into your whatever is in front of you, it can be quite hard to say, okay, that's probably good enough, let's move on and make some time that way.
Yeah, so you get more efficient.
That's right.
I forget that the quote that I've heard is something like, if you want something done, give it to a busy person.
Yeah,
a busy person has figured out, by necessity, they've had to figure out how to do things quickly and how to turn over the things quickly that can be turned over quickly.
Yeah, or a lazy person, because they'll find an easier way.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's the basis of like 90% of writing scripts for programming, right? It's like, I don't want to go through and, you know, manually copy all of these files. I want to write something that will just do everything for
You're
me.
You're really lining up your laziness, you know.
Yeah.
Do I want to spend half an hour writing this code, or do I want to spend 20 minutes doing this boring task, which I'll have to do again next week.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you got to work with Trevor McDougall some, right?
Yeah, okay, yeah. So I guess after my PhD, I was offered very quickly. So I spent, my PhD lasted 3 years and 9 months. So funding is 3 years, and back then you got more or less an automatic extension of six months. And then for my last 3 months, I was furiously writing up. I was very lucky enough that one of the heads of the group, Richard Coleman, he found some extra cash in his back pocket that allowed me to continue eating for those final 3 months. And I guess this is something that a lot of PhD students fall into. The last year is really hectic. You spend a lot of time writing and thinking and stressing. And so I didn't have a lot of time for considering what was happening after the PhD.
Oh, yeah.
And so I sort of handed it in, and suddenly there was this big void in my life. I'm like, what am I doing? I need to earn some money. How's this going to work?
The dog caught its tail.
Yeah.
And that happened. I know what you mean. That experience of like, oh, now what? Wait a second.
Yeah. And very fortuitously, my other supervisor, who was Steve Rintoul,
who
worked at CSIRO. So Nathan was University of Tas, Steve was CSIRO. There was this nice... All the institutes in Tasmania are very mashed up. They're all separate entities with different funding streams, but the people who sit at the desks often belong to one or both or several of them. So it's a really nice community. So the PhD was shared between those two groups. And at that point, Steve was quite senior at CSIRO, and he actually had to take a temporary acting director role, which meant that the science he was doing wasn't going to get done.
Yeah.
So I managed to land a very easy, quick postdoc that was basically like a necessity thing. I think I was very fortunate at that point. Throughout my entire scientific career, I feel like I've been very fortunate.
It's nice when it works out.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's good to... I'm trying to do this too. It's good you know, you have that sense of gratitude about it. And I think it's important to keep in mind that, you know, you need some kind of combination of hard work and the right circumstances. You need both of those things to happen, that it's not, you know, it's not automatic. Like, just because you're working hard doesn't mean the other stuff is going to line up the way you picture it.
Yeah.
I mean, something can work out if you keep going at it and going after it, but yeah, it's a... There's some luck in there.
Yeah, totally. Well, you know, yeah. Like, aside from actually doing science, is the rest of your life that sort of happens outside of that.
Yes.
And I was really fortunate in that things continually lined up there. So my wife basically supported me being a penniless student and continuing to be a student. Mm-hmm. So she was working as an engineer at the same place she got her job at straight out of undergraduate throughout my entire PhD. And during that time, we bought a house. Well, you know, she bought a house.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, during the PhD, you also, you know, at the start, it's a bit of fun. And towards the end, it's a very hard graft. I think I was doing 80-hour weeks at the end, which probably meant I wasn't working hard enough at the start.
A bit of a grind, the writing part.
That last part, you know. Yeah. I think writing is... I've always found writing quite hard. It shouldn't be. But I always find reasons to make one more plot and that sort of thing.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because I like to talk about that with everyone. Like, what have you learned about kind of writing and how do you approach it now? What do you do?
I'm increasingly realizing that at some point, you have to stop. And it's the same with the PhD. You can continue doing your PhD forever, but at some point, you just have to let it die. You take your hands off and say, there's enough stuff here. I know I could branch out more of this infinitely, but at some point, you say, that's enough. And
that's right.
And I'm increasingly doing the same with my research. And so I look at the figures or the stuff I'm working with and look at the story it's telling. And when the story is basically... you know, at the end of a paragraph or at the end of a few paragraphs, and you think, okay, there's a little coherent idea here. At that point, I'm encouraged to write it up. You know, obviously, there's more things that you could ask. You could look at it in different ways. You could say, well, the work that I've just done implies further work. Should I do that? And I think the answer is often no. I prefer to write shorter papers, and I prefer to read them as well. But coherent, nicely encapsulated ideas. But that's also very hard to do as a PhD student. It's very hard to understand when you're entering any field. It's hard to know what that idea...
You don't have that intuition yet.
That's right. You need to have a feel for the space and have an idea that idea is interesting, hasn't been done before, contributes to the body of science, and is something that other people will actually find interesting.
Yeah.
So that was something that was hard as a student. I didn't really know exactly what a paper should look like properly. I'd read lots, obviously, but I didn't really know how they came up with these novel and interesting ideas. And what I'm finding now is that once you start the ball rolling with your science, and if you stay in the same field, you basically, all these ideas just spread away from it, and each one is an encapsulated idea of a paper.
And then at some point you realize it's about communicating with people, and the longer you kind of stay in science or around science, you start to learn about your audience and what they are listening for and like what they will want to see in a paper.
Absolutely.
And that just takes time and just being in the community. So that's one of the hard things about starting out is when you don't know your audience yet. You don't know who you're writing for exactly. Like, you know conceptually, but not on a level of, oh, this will speak to the community that I'm trying to reach and that will get to them.
Or is necessary, or, you know, the community is continually, there's a hole in the community's knowledge and we have the skills to address that, we should do that. I quite like telling scientific stories. Although I find writing hard, I find giving talks quite easy and I quite enjoy doing them, and they are inevitably in these scientific conferences little encapsulated 12-minute ideas. In 12 minutes you don't have a lot of time to communicate a complex scientific idea. But usually you get the story across, and it usually has a start, reason, motivations, and how you did it, and then conclusions, right? And I find that very easy to do, and I've done it on many, many more topics than I've actually written papers. So I really just need to take those stories and add in that extra bit of rigor that makes it a paper.
Yeah. So what was moving to the British Antarctic Survey like, where we're now sitting?
It was big, right? So it was the first time. So my wife and I had travelled quite a lot. So during our undergraduate years and also during PhD a bit, we'd done a fair bit of backpacking. We'd backpacked across Europe and we'd backpacked across South America. But still, the longest period of time I'd ever spent away from Hobart was 3 months on an icebreaker.
Yeah.
So I'd never really moved away that far away. And so that both of our families were in Hobart, so we were both quite linked with our families. We had our own house, but, you know, we still saw everyone very regularly. And so really, it was both of our entire support networks. We just said, okay, let's go.
Yeah, it's hard. Really hard.
But at the same time, it was also time, right? We had been in Hobart for almost 30 years, our entire lives. And we realized through our traveling that there's so much more out in the world, and we knew we wanted to see some of that. And so when the position came up with Bass, I read the description and think, they do everything exactly, they do exactly the sort of stuff I do, but it's a much too high a level. I can't lead voyages, I've never done that. I can't write grants, I hadn't done that. But I'll write it down and see where we go, because I need practice applying for jobs.
Yeah.
And so I had to do my interview over Skype. I was in Melbourne in a conference at the time, so I went to my brother's house. He wasn't in, fortunately, and it was like about 9 or 10 p.m. or something, so it was quite late, which was a really big time difference.
Yeah.
And then Skype didn't work, and so I had to do it just talking to a phone sitting on the desk. But very fortunately, because Skype wasn't working, it meant they couldn't see me. So I had to give a presentation, so it was sort of like next slide, and they'd just advance it at the other side of the world. But I had to do a little bio of myself, and because they couldn't see me, I just put a picture of Brad Pitt on the front, and I think that really helped. I said, that's me.
That's the secret. So lie on your resume.
Yeah. Well,
I'm kidding, of course, but you know.
Well, it also helped because they couldn't see me, and it was stinking hot. It was a period of really strong bushfire, really bad bushfires in Melbourne, like really bad ones. But it also meant it was like 40 degrees or something. So I think I was sitting there in my boxer shorts, and I had a beer because it was late and I'd given my talk that day.
Yeah.
And so I think that made it feel a lot more informal to me and more relaxed.
Yeah, you were more relaxed. No, and the Brad Pitt thing, I think it's great that it worked, because what I mean by worked is like it was funny, and I'm sure it sounds like it went over well.
Yeah, looking back now, it could have been completely miscued, or depending on who was interviewing me. It was Mike Meredith and Emily Shapra, both of whom who lead our group now, who have good senses of humour. And it has to be said that like the British mentality and the Australian one are quite similar. We're, you know, like just distant cousins, really.
Yeah.
We're all very, actually close cousins.
Yeah. But I guess had it been someone more formal, they might have like, why isn't this person taking this seriously?
Yeah, exactly. I'd like to feel like the rest of the presentation was backed up with some serious science.
Yeah.
And I'd thought quite hard about the sort of questions that they might ask and what the British Antarctic Survey actually does. And I had a pretty good, because I'd done two postdocs by that point, so I had quite a good feel for the Southern Ocean, and I'd looked at large-scale circulation problems, and I'd looked at coastal convection problems, and I'd been working with some people in Krill, so I was a little bit cross-disciplinary. And it didn't hurt at all that both of my supervisors, Steve Rintle, Nathan Bindoff, and Trevor McDougall, who was my last postdoc supervisor, and Bernadette Sloan as well, were all sort of very well known in the international community. They knew the people I was talking to, they knew Mike and Emily, and so it came from a good pedigree, basically.
Yeah.
And I think that's something that's really important in science, not necessarily the pedigree, but being known to each other, that community, because in any scientific field, you know, the more you dig down into it, the smaller and smaller the group is of people who actually understand what you're talking about. And it really is important to communicate with them what your ideas are through meetings and through just emails.
Yeah.
It was something that was very, it took a long time coming to me to write, just if I had a question about a paper that was written by someone who was a big name in the field, rather than sitting there and wondering what they meant, you can just write to them. You know, they are very approachable. They're genuinely, well, at least in my experience, genuinely keen to hear someone who's interested in their work and happy to clarify or assist or in any way, really.
Yeah, that's right. No, scientists don't get a lot of emails like that. They don't get a lot of emails from people who are interested in their work and want to know more about it.
It was sort of intimidating for me because I'd read all these papers and they were, you know, the big name in the field. They're just a person. And it sort of came down to me when I was hosting a group of scientists from Japan in Hobart. And one of the key researchers there, Shigeru Aoki, who was, you know, he was a big name in the field. And so I was sort of tiptoeing around him, being friendly and sort of bowing down a bit. But, you know, just being...
Not literally.
Well, a little bit. There's a little bit of bowing when you work with Japanese people. But, you know, I was treating him as you know, a revered person in the field. And we were out at a pub in sort of the central tourist area in Hobart, and then a bunch of my friends happened to be there. They just came in independently, and they weren't linked to oceanography at all, so they had no idea who this guy was. And they'd had a little bit to drink, and they were having so much fun with him, because he was just another guy, just a person off the street who was visiting Hobart, and they just treated him like anyone else. And I realised that, oh, well, you know, while he's a giant or really important in the field, he's just any other person, and it's very easy to, well, as a student, it's easy to forget that. And they like that. They appreciate it being treated as regular humans.
Now, this is good, because one of the questions I've been thinking about lately is, you know, as a community, are we doing enough to try to include people who might not have good geographical access to that community? And but I think the point you're bringing up, you know, emphasizes that, like, yeah, us as a community, we probably could do more. We probably should be having that conversation and thinking about how to be more inclusive and how not to just you know, limit our attention to the, you know, folks who come out of a small handful of research groups over the world. But then what you're saying is also really valuable, that, you know, if you want to get involved in some aspect of science, at least for our field anyway, you know, speaking for us, you can contact people directly, and you can just let them know you're interested. You can put yourself out there. You know, if you can, you can try to do a little bit of work either on your own or with a mentor somewhere. Mm-hmm. And luckily, you know, you don't have to be in the same physical location to have that kind of mentoring relationship anymore. So I think both are important. Like, as a community, we should ask ourselves about that and maybe do more to be more inclusive. But also, yeah, if you're a person outside of the community, you can also do things that will help make that connection.
Yeah, and I think as a PhD, it can be very easy to spend those 3 or 4 years just burrowed into your work and not communicating too much with the outside world, simply because you think, well, you know, at this stage, I haven't got anything that I feel comfortable with the outside world seeing. I want to make this perfect science. But really, it's much more valuable to send those emails just so those people who will be your future peers and employers know your name, know who you are, and know that you're working in this space, even if they haven't really seen what you're producing. Just a few of the figures that you're working with, or the ideas that you're playing with, are really valuable, just to start those conversations and put your name in their heads, I think.
Make yourself familiar.
And so when opportunities do come up, or when pieces of work that they're working, or something, some scientific idea that they're toying with lines up with what you're doing, they can say, oh, I know this person, maybe they're interested, and they just shoot you the email, and things start from there. It always starts from these sort of small, fairly incidental pieces of work. So I had something like that with Alberto at Southampton. So I was a PhD student in Hobart.
Alberto, is his last name?
Naviera Garabata.
Nice job. Yeah. I knew what it was, but I wasn't confident about saying it.
I think I got the accent quite right.
That's okay, I think we're allowed some leeway.
Yeah, Alberto, I'm sorry. and I just sent I saw some work that he was doing, and fairly unsolicited, I sent him some figures from work that I was doing that was very parallel to the sort of to what he was looking at. And he immediately wrote back to me and said, hey, would you like to come over here for 2 weeks?
Oh, nice.
And so I basically went to Southampton for my first little scientific collaboration and work with Alberto. And although in the end not too much came out of that particular idea, Alberto and I built a little rapport, and so he knew about me. And later on, when I was coming to the UK, it just made it so much easier to integrate with the community, having those links.
Yeah, absolutely.
We've since worked and published together. So.
Yeah, so you need to have the goods. You know, you need to have some scientific interest and some work.
Yeah, but I think interest is enough. No, it doesn't need to be, I mean, not that I'm advocating not finishing things, but it doesn't need to be polished to start these conversations. You need to, and often it really benefits from talking to these people who have more experience about your ideas. Even if they're not fully formed, they can help you steer them in the right direction.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, have the goods, make yourself familiar, email people.
That's right. And imposter syndrome is a big thing. But everyone has it, right? It's very easy to assume these experts know everything, but they know a lot about a very small amount, and it's very easy to stray outside their expertise. And they're not afraid to say that either. So I think having confidence that the work you're doing is as good as anyone else.
One piece of advice I also got from one of my history professors was, he just flat out said, ride your advisor's coattails. And I'm doing his voice a little bit. Hopefully he doesn't mind that. Yeah, ride your advisor's coattails. You know, and you need to have the work, and but if you do get connected with somebody who is well known, you know, that's something you can draw on. I mean, you do eventually want to be distinct, and but just the fact that you can be a little bit familiar, you know, like, oh, by the way, I know this person, I'm connected with this person, that does help. I mean, we are humans, we're like social creatures, so that's part of how we work. We work based on these networks.
Yeah, and there's like going to conferences. I think I remember my very first international conference. I knew there was going to be lots of international scientists there, and I wanted to, you know, network with them.
Yeah.
And I thought the way to do that was basically to pin them down and blast them with my science, which wasn't necessarily what they were interested in.
Fire hose.
Yeah. And you have these weird force. Well, I had these weird force conversations with people, sort of telling them about my poster at the time, in fields that they are nominally related to.
Yeah.
And you'd see their eyes sort of glaze over after a couple of minutes, and you think. But what was much more valuable was going out to the pub with my peers, other PhD students, early postdocs, and having relaxed human conversations. Not necessarily, you know, there was a fair bit of sort of shop talk, but there was also talk about all sorts of other stuff.
Yeah.
And those people have since gone on to be peers in other institutes, and we have these really good working relationships.
Yeah.
And so just that casual networking, going out to dinner at conferences and things, was really valuable too. Yeah. Science is not done in a vacuum. You need to talk to these people.
Yeah, you got to hang out. You got to be.
That's
you got to be around.
Just hanging out and passing the time of the day was really key to building those networks. Not the nailing, cornering some poor professor in a corner in the poster hall.
Yeah. So what Andrew's saying is, don't corner him and blast him with. I'm kidding.
But go and hang out with your peers. Don't just sort of find the biggest name in the hall and try and talk to them about your work when it's not necessarily, like, if it is related, absolutely go
yeah,
nail them
definitely,
down, ask their
definitely,
ideas.
Yeah.
But if it's just that they're also an oceanographer, maybe that's. Don't feel stressed if you're not talking to the biggest scientists in the room. Talk to your peers.
Yeah, we're a small community anyway, so by the time you meet 10 people, you're probably connected to just about everybody else in the
field.
That's
right,
yeah,
there's only
one
or two steps between everyone.
Yeah, that's right. So you've led a lot of research cruises. I wanted to talk about that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah. So do you like that experience of being a PSO? And I mean, you were a PSO on the one cruise that I was on, and you seem to be enjoying yourself. What is that?
Yeah, that's true. So I do like going to sea. It's certainly something that's going to be harder going forward now that I'm a father, and, you know, disappearing for months at a time is not something that's going to be much fun for my family or for me. Like, you know, missing your kids and missing your family is going to be hard. But prior to that, I certainly did enjoy the adventure. I've always really liked the idea of adventure, and I always sort of wanted adventures, and going to Antarctica on a ship thousands of kilometres from the nearest anything is certainly a good adventure. So I did two voyages during my PhD and learnt the fundamentals of physical oceanography and life aboard ships.
Yeah.
And the Australian ships are certainly, the way the Australians do it is a bit different from the way the UK does it, in that the Australians only have one ship, so it has to do everything. It has a much, much bigger geographic area to cover. It has to supply all the bases and do the science. And because you only get one or two of these big marine science voyages, it's not just a small group of people doing one particular project. It's multiple groups doing several different projects, which may or may not overlap, but they at least are in the same geographic region.
Yeah.
So it's very multidisciplinary, which can be valuable for the science coming out, but it can also make lots of operational issues when the biologists really want to do a trawl and the physicists want to do a CTD, and you can't have all these things dangling over the side of the ship at once. Can lead to raised tempers and things like that. Whereas in the UK ships, in my experience, the voyages tend to be much over much shorter geographic areas. The people, therefore, the ship can do more of the voyages, so you can have smaller groups on more targeted science, which is very, very valuable. Also, the Australian ships, everyone's in together. So the crew and the officers and the scientists are all one big happy family with the usual frictions that come with happy families. Whereas in the UK ships, it's a sort of a hangover from the maritime, I guess their merchant marine background, or the Navy background even. BASS was, when it was formed, was at least quasi-military. And so there's this quite strong distinction between the crew and the officers and the scientists. which isn't necessarily bad. It means the crew have their own space, and they don't necessarily have their bosses leaning over their shoulders when they're trying to recreate. But it also does feel a bit weird.
It does feel weird, yeah.
It's not very egalitarian.
But like you said, they can complain about us, you know, weird scientists, if they want to, and that's valuable.
Yeah, they basically have a space they can... I mean, the crew are absolutely allowed in the officers' bar, but officers are not allowed in the crew bar.
Right.
I guess that's the other thing. The UK ships are wet, and the Australian ships... They used to be very similar in the way things were run, but they were taken over by P&O, like the cruise company, and...
Oh.
They were owned by the ship was owned by P&O.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and so they wanted to harmonise all their rules. So they basically said no alcohol on the ships. And so I was on the very first voyage. My first voyage was the first voyage when that rule had been instituted, and it was a resentful ship, not to each other, but towards the administration. I think at one point there was a public forum called, and people harangued. There was some fairly senior members of the executive on board. They were being transported back from Antarctica, and they got harangued for about 3 hours in a very spirited public forum about this. And the UK ships don't have these rules.
They didn't think about that. They're like, we're going to have to ride with these people.
Yeah, we have to live with these guys in a very small... So at that point, there was about 70 people, which is very crowded. We had 4 people in a cabin. And the cabin's not very big. Yeah. It's maybe 2 metres by 3 metres or something. It's small.
Not much personal space.
No. I mean, that was just transit. We weren't trying to do any science at that point. We were just coming home, but it's still a long transit.
Could you still... Did you have an ability to at least pull a curtain or something and have a tiny little bit of space?
Yeah, you had a bunk's worth of space.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you pull the curtain around.
Don't sit up. Yeah, you can't...
No, you couldn't sit up. If you're on the top, you couldn't sit up either. You hit the roof.
You have a place to lay down, and that's it. That's all you have.
But,
yeah.
You know, for a PhD student, it was really exciting. I really loved the adventure. And spending that amount of time in a very isolated ship. So it did have satellite comms, but you got about 30 kilobytes worth of email a day.
Yeah.
So it was just text, no photos. You couldn't do a back and forth conversation. It just got sent off in one squirt, and then a little bit later in the day, emails came back maybe.
Hmm.
So it really made the ship isolated, a real community. Obviously there's no television or anything.
Yeah.
And so it was a very unique style of life, which I hadn't encountered before. And there's a lot of camaraderie, and people, you make very close friendships on those sorts of ships when you're sharing that space for 3 months.
Yeah, definitely. Or even a few weeks you can have some chats in the bar with people and get to know them and start to feel familiar. And
Absolutely. And I think that was one of the values that the UK ships have in still having, you know, sensible amounts of alcohol available, is that, you know, like it or not, that's sort of how a lot of society works, and alcohol is that social lubricant. When it's in your hand, it's relaxed time.
Yeah.
And it was a way of taking the pressure off after a long shift and just bonding more.
It's become a theme of this podcast,
yeah,
of this episode. Of,
yeah, sorry. This is what happens when you have Australians in. You can just talk about drinking the whole time.
No, it's useful in college, you know, for...
I have a beer right now, it's 11 o'clock in the morning.
On ships, you know, in the office, after work, during work, if conditions are good or bad. I guess really good or really bad.
Really good or really bad. Yeah.
Drink responsibly. No.
I hadn't noticed, but now you've made me aware of it. I think I should see someone.
I'm here to help. There's a van right outside, actually. We're ready to transport you now. We care about you. One of the things I wanted to talk about, and this is the segment of the podcast where I talk about how awesome you are and make you feel uncomfortable.
This is not good.
Happy with that. No, this is going to make you feel weird. So one of the things that I got to watch from working with you and seeing you on the ship as the principal scientific officer is you're really calm under pressure. And I think you are really, you know, I've never really seen you get stressed out. I've seen, like, I don't know, on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is like crazy stressed out and 1 is completely calm. I think for you, I see you hovering between a 3 and a 5, but kind of, you know, gently, you know, just kind of, and the 5 is just slightly more energetic. It's not like you're not like stressed. You're just like, so I don't know if you thought about that, but you seem to be, you've got like a reservoir of calm. And I really like, I really like working with calm people. My advisor was super chill. I think I've mentioned that to you before. You know, he's the calmest person I've ever known. He never gets stressed out. He's very, very zen. Mm-hmm. And you know, even when things aren't going as he'd like, he doesn't worry about it at all. Yeah, and I've kind of noticed you have a similar like calm disposition, which I saw that helps you on the ship. You know, when decisions needed to be made quickly, or you know, big decisions needed to happen, you just kind of did it, and you didn't get stressed out.
I mean, I won't say I wasn't stressed. I'm particularly at the start of voyages, and well, in lots of other circumstances, I certainly get stressed.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I've never found a lot of value in losing your cool.
Yeah.
These sorts of things always, I mean, sometimes that can be an issue because I like to step back and if a problem arises, I like to have a think about it and see, consider other people's motives and what might be causing issues and, you know, how various decisions I might make might play out.
Yeah.
Which can sometimes mean you can snap decisions. Don't always happen as efficiently as you might like, but otherwise, I've always found it much more workable to keep calm.
Is it something you had to learn, or have you always been?
I guess I've always been relatively calm about these things. Although you know, there is a hole in the door in the downstairs of my parents' house. It's currently covered by a CD where I punched a hole in it when I can't remember what happened. Something must have really annoyed me, but I smashed my hand right into that door, and I was really surprised when I didn't. I guess I never thought about it too hard, but interior doors are hollow.
Yeah,
went straight through it.
Wait a minute.
Yeah.
Was this a possibly a sibling related thing?
No, it wasn't
a sibling related thing.
I think it might have been a MS Word related thing. I think.
Oh, that makes sense. No, you're totally off the off the hook.
Yeah, it might have been something to do with. I think it might have been a document I was working on forever and it died.
Yeah.
And then the save file was corrupt, and then I think I stood up and stepped away from the computer, and then punched a hole in the door.
No, that makes total sense. I think you're 100% justified.
Yeah.
When you explained it to your parents, were they like, oh, I get it?
I think the bits of door sticking out of my hand were a bit more concerned about.
Yeah, okay. No, I didn't know there were bits of door embedded in your hand. So yeah, it wasn't a clean punch through the door.
It was a splintery punch through the door.
Oh, okay.
But it certainly took my mind right off the word thing. So in that sense, it worked.
Oh, no.
It was a nice shiny CD over the hole in the door.
Maybe you should pick it up again. You just start punching things. It worked last time.
Yeah, so I maybe not calm, but maybe it's more like a pressure vessel with really, really thick walls.
Oh God! So you're gonna lose it one day. You're gonna like, that's it.
Now I'm in. Now I'm discovering the world of working with toddlers. I'm trying to become more zen calm.
Yes.
Like, toddlers can be very frustrating to deal with. But there's absolutely no point in losing your temper.
No, that's right.
So, and you know, it's not helping anyone. So I think, yeah, toddlers and research scientists are really they're quite similar in some ways. Particularly research scientists on a ship who are pushing their own project. So,
emotional management.
Yeah,
yeah, that's one of your jobs as dad and principal scientific officer, and group leader. Emotional management, expectation management.
Yeah, I mean, I've been quite lucky in my voyages in that sense that things have mostly gone right. Not too many stuff has broken. Ship stayed okay. People have stayed generally healthy. Ice hasn't been terrible. I've had to make a couple of calls, which were sort of tough in the sense that I had to tell one guy who'd come along for the express purposes of getting some moorings out of the ocean and turning them around and putting some new ones back in, that we weren't going to go there because the ice was coming in and we were going to get stuck and we needed... Basically, other people's work took priority over just messing around in the ice, hoping that we were going to get him and get his moorings. And so having to come and have that conversation with him was pretty hard because that was his whole job, and risking these moorings were expensive and things like that. But that's what happens with Antarctic operations. Sometimes stuff happens and you have to make decisions around that. And that was like my first ones, and I'm really happy that he took it calmly and reasonably. And having someone get up in my face and really aggressive is... about their projects, because you know passions can be really high about stuff you've put a lot of effort into, and having someone tell you, no, sorry, this other person's work's less risky than yours, basically.
Have you had that happen? Has somebody like been really confrontational about it, or
not with me?
Not with you.
I've seen it happen to other people, and I've certainly heard about it happening. Like, there's been some fairly there's certainly some sort of legendary stories going around about people who've really flipped out on the ship about stuff that's gone wrong, or from interpersonal conflicts that you can have a very close community, but you also can't get away with away from people who rub you the wrong way. And I've never had this issue. I haven't had this come up, but I know it's a possibility. And even if they're not actually angry with me, they might be. You might have to manage two people who just turns out they can't stand each other.
Yeah.
So yeah,
that's a really good parallel. Thinking about, and it. I mean, I know you said it kind of half jokingly, but there's some truth to it in that. How do you respond to anger, whether it's coming from your toddler or coming from, you know, a colleague or somebody on the ship? And like you said, it doesn't help anybody to reflect it back at them, because then they're going to reflect it back at you again. You make a little positive feedback loop, and things just get worse and worse until they end up somewhere really unfortunate, potentially. Or you can kind of absorb the anger or kind of sidestep it. And that's such a good skill to have. That's such a good emotional skill to have. I'm better at that than I used to be, and I'm still working on it. I'm still like, that's a skill set I desperately want, is to just be able to, you know, when confronted with anger, to just be able to, like, you know, absorb it or just dissipate it in that way. And to like, well, I'm not going to get more angry. I'm not going to, like, reflect that back at you. I mean, that being said, you don't want to, like, suppress your emotions all the time. So it's more about channeling them into something else, or putting them somewhere else, or, like, cooling off. Yeah, it's a good skill set.
Yeah, actually, now I think about it, I think I'm much happier dealing with the frustrations that, or anger or interpersonal conflicts with people, like ones that, like toddlers or angry scientists, than I am with computers. I find that I really like a computer that doesn't work, slow internet, or something that's grinding. My wife will notice it when I'm sitting on my lap next to her on the couch playing on the laptop, or something. And then it decides not to work, or it decides to be really slow for no apparent reason. She'll just see like veins bulging in my forehead.
Because with people,
tell me to put it down.
Because with people, you can give them the benefit of the doubt, and you can like, all right, I know it's tough to be a person and to have emotions and things, and so you're dealing with something right now, and let me help you with that. But with a computer, it just should work. Yeah, why isn't this just working?
Yeah. Rage at inanimate objects is much more understandable.
Absolutely. That's awesome. So we talked about a few things, a lot of things. We talked about a lot of this stuff. I'm looking at my list now. We talked about a lot of this. Actually, that's a pretty nice way to transition into talking about the whole machine learning thing. Because, I don't know, we talk about people's paths into science on the podcast, but there's no reason we couldn't also talk about some science bits, right? That's totally on the table.
Yeah.
So in thinking about how infuriating machines can be, let's talk about how you're interested in spending a lot of time with machine learning and trying to, I'm trying to be lighthearted about it, but I'm trying to find a way into like, so there's something that's emerging right now where machine learning, all those techniques exist, the techniques have been developed by the engineering community for the past few decades, and it's only been kind of just recently that the oceanographic and climate data sets have gotten big enough that we can apply some of those machine learning techniques to them. So we're kind of in a nice era right now. We have a nice opportunity to start applying some of those machine learning tools to ocean data, and hopefully getting something out. Hopefully it won't make us too mad. Hopefully we won't start punching our laptops as a result. I guess we might. So I don't know. Do we want to talk about that, or do you got some interesting?
Absolutely. I think my interest in it really is just recognizing how important it will be for all fields of science ultimately, but also in sort of the excitement in realizing that here's something that is very likely to be the next big thing. It already is the next big thing in several fields, obviously in computer science, but things like medical imaging, and natural speech recognition. There's so many areas where machine learning is already revolutionizing how we actually do science and produce really useful tools. And so it's obvious that it has applications in all the other fields of science, but in very few of them, and ours included, it hasn't really been taken up very much. And that's partly because people don't necessarily recognize that it is the next big thing, although I think increasingly they're aware of it, but also because it's not quite suitable in its present form.
Yeah.
Like, so the stuff that's really, like machine learning and artificial intelligence has been around largely its present form for probably 20 or 30 years now. But it's only really since the advent of genuinely huge data sets and really fast computers that you can apply deep neural networks on.
Yeah.
That we've had this explosion of, you know, very cool machine learning applications like AlphaGo, like the Google DeepMind computer that could suddenly beat the world champion at Go, which was supposedly the most complex, you know, fully constrained game out there. It was a problem that they said could never be solved in the next several decades, and then just went and did it.
It just happened. Yeah.
Image recognition. We do it in our phones all the time. You know, it recognizes our face to unlock and that sort of thing. Yeah, that sort of pattern and image recognition was something that computers were really bad at not very long ago. And then suddenly using algorithms that already existed, but applying those algorithms to really the large ensembles of data. So, you know, the fact that Google and Facebook and the NSA have been gathering these vast quantities of anonymized, inverted commas, data, you can suddenly use that to train these wonderful tools on and apply it to very fast machines that can have many, many levels of neural networks, and suddenly these amazing results pop out. But unfortunately, taking those amazing results and applying it to our field of oceanography isn't just taking someone else's code and plugging in oceanography rather than a picture of someone's face. there is definitely areas where we can do some things like that. Say we wanted to, like one of the things we look at a lot is sea ice extent, for example. We're interested in identifying icebergs, finding out where the edge of the ice is, which isn't always easy because ice isn't just ice water, it's ice, and then there's, as you discovered in the voyage, there's many, many different sorts of ice.
Yeah. Pancake ice, slush, and
grease ice, and nihilus, and fractured ice, and ridged ice, and there's an awful lot of ice. And looking at a photo from a satellite isn't always obvious where the edge of the ice is. And so if you want to know if the ice is growing or retreating, which is a big deal, you need to be able to look through millions and millions and millions of these images of ice edge and then identify correctly the edge of the ice. And because it isn't a simple, you know, water is black, ice is white sort of thing, you can't easily apply an algorithm. So often people are sitting there looking at photos, applying their own little neural network in their head and clicking the edges. But those are the sorts of problems that machine learning is really good at.
The original neural network.
Yeah. it's not a hugely long bow to draw to suggest that, you know, humans' brains work in similar ways. We're really good at pattern recognition, and that's essentially what these things are, they're pattern recognition.
Yeah. This is something I've been trying to think about as well, because, you know, all the machine learning techniques are very much about, you don't give the algorithm too much information beforehand necessarily. You give it a lot of data, but you don't necessarily tell it, okay, mass is conserved and energy is conserved. We don't tend to give it the physics necessarily, like in that sense.
And often having physics, you know, come back out the other end along with some new interesting relationships is a good indication that it's working, right?
So I guess one attitude I've encountered a little bit in talking with some scientists about applying machine learning to oceanography is they kind of say, well, so what? I can write down a simple kind of energy balance model and get physical intuition that way. So why should I worry about this other orthogonal approach? It's better to just use a box model. And I'm not saying that's my position, but it's one of the positions I've encountered. And I don't have a great reply yet, because I guess my first thought is, it's supposed to be, the whole machine learning thing is supposed to be kind of orthogonal to that approach of, you know, starting with the physics and deriving things directly from the physics, which I'm a big fan of. That's awesome. That's, you know, most of what I'm doing. So it's just about having an additional set of tools in your toolbox for me. I don't know. Do you have thoughts about that?
I completely agree with them. You want that physical understanding. But at the same time, when you're dealing with these like dynamic, chaotic systems, you need perfect physical understanding, which is impossible to get, to make perfect prediction. And also just having understanding how the fundamentals of physics work doesn't necessarily tell you what those emergent structures are going to be when you take a whole bunch of those, you know, basic physical parameters, put them in a grid and then tell them to start passing water between them. You don't necessarily see how, you know, a gyre will evolve or eddies will evolve or these structures will emerge. And you certainly, those codes certainly don't tell you how those large-scale emergent things interact with one another. And those sort of patterns is, that's what we spend a lot of our time doing, right? Is trying to understand how this very, very dynamic, complex system, coupled system. So when we look at climate models, we're talking about the ocean is talking to the sea ice, is talking to the land ice, is talking to the atmosphere, is talking to the biosphere, is talking to all the chemical reactions going on.
Yeah.
And that is mind-numbingly complex. In theory, in each of these fields, we have a good, pretty good physical understanding of the very basic stuff, how this works. We know how light is, air absorbs light. We know how it's re-emitted. We know about absorption spectrums and things like that.
And all of that is happening on every scale, every spatial scale, down to the tiniest spatial scale to the largest ones.
And the truth is, we can't always model it. We can't model everything. We can't model every single atom. So we start making approximations. And we can make the, and then we hope those approximations produce that emergent structure. And what machine learning can do is say, well, hey, you don't need to model every single atom. We can detect what this emergent structure is. And we can look at the relationships. So basically, we can see these patterns coming out, and we can link those patterns to, link those patterns to properties within the model. For example, you can look at relationships you didn't necessarily see, covariances or causal covariances that aren't immediately obvious, and certainly isn't obvious in just looking at the fundamental, like fluid dynamical equations. I don't want to say science is post-analytic understanding, but we're looking at increasingly complex systems in so many of our fields, and just trying to understand how elements of those interact with other elements. So you push here in the ocean, we change the winds around Antarctica, so that's going to have huge knock-on effects all over the world, and the equations don't tell you what they will be. You need to run a model and see.
Yeah.
But you don't see it when you look at a model. Even though you've got perfect understanding of what the model's showing, you're not necessarily looking everywhere. You can try and correlate every single metric with every other single metric to see if there's some that seem to line up.
Hmm.
Or you can use these machine learning approaches that look at patterns that come out, and they start sort of highlighting where you might want to look for more physical understanding. So I think they're really potentially amazingly useful tools for analyzing these models.
Yeah. Have you encountered, earlier you mentioned that professor who was like, ah, computers, big fad. Have you encountered much of that attitude in talking about machine learning?
Jovially, yes. Everyone mentioned is saying, oh no, you either want to automate our own jobs or you're looking at things that are far too simple to, if anything you can describe using this is trivial, which is not the case. But I think most people just say that because machine learning is definitely a buzzword. And machine learning or artificial intelligence or these sort of things can be applied meaningfully to algorithms we already use every day. EOF's a very, very simple way of, the work that...
Empirical orthogonal functions,
orthogonal functions.
The statistical tool,
Singular value decompositions, basically. the work that you and I recently did with a very smart summer student was basically taking a whole bunch of Gaussian profiles, curves, and trying to approximate a more complex curve with a whole bunch of those stacked on top of each other. People wouldn't immediately say that's machine learning. That's a technique that's been around for a very long time.
Yeah.
But
linear algebra and statistics.
the machine learning element that came out of that was we were letting the machine decide how basically best to produce those in the most efficient way. So it can be easy for people to be overwhelmed by the buzzwords without necessarily being aware of the potential that it holds.
I remember seeing a talk, I think it was EGU, where, it doesn't matter, where this person was present, this scientist presented, they were classifying, I think they were looking at wave images using satellites, and somebody in the audience asked at the end, said, have you ever thought about using machine learning to do this? And the speaker's response was like, well, I don't know. By the time you teach a machine how to do this, you could just do it yourself. And I remember that answer, it wasn't very satisfying, right? It kind of hit the room and you kind of felt this like, people didn't really react to it. Because I think there was a sense of like, that's probably not the direction things are going to go in. Like that, you could try to do everything manually still, and there might still be cases where that is the best approach, but that's certainly not the direction everything's going.
And I think machine learning a lot of, so I gave some examples with the CIS of where machine learning could be applied to our field, but there's other, it's not immediately obvious how it could be applied to a lot of the understanding the dynamics that we do, right?
Yeah.
There's not any sort of off-the-shelf algorithms that are already working really nicely in other fields we can just plug into our models and get wonderful science out of. So there needs to be some real work done in sort of combining the existing machine learning tools, and this is, has to be done with the researchers who are really computer scientists and understand that sort of data analytics, in collaboration with oceanographers and geophysicists to build new tools that are appropriate for applying to our very large models, which are increasingly, you know, data intense. They are gigantic. They have petabytes and petabytes of information. And to suggest that
it's
we're going to
worse,
sit through that by hand and understand these incredibly complex systems by hand is and it's just going to get worse. Yeah,
it's going to get worse. Yeah.
So really, we need machine learning as a tool and other tools to facilitate our understanding of these models. We're making them so complex that we are essentially building new Earths, and the only benefit you have is these ones are easier to look at.
Yeah, you can observe every point.
Yeah,
every
you can
time.
Observe every point every time, but they're still outstandingly complex, and we don't understand why they do what they do all the time, despite the fact that we explicitly told them exactly how to do it.
Yeah, but it's like you said, the emergent, you put all of the physics and the chemistry and the biology all together, and they start interacting on every scale, and some, you know, crazy stuff that you might not have predicted emerges from that, you
That's
know, combination.
Right, yeah. It is the complexity of, so they are genuinely chaotic beasts.
It's kind of like we know a lot about atoms, but knowing everything about atoms wouldn't tell you about, like, oh yeah, there's this guy Beethoven who's going to exist and he's going to write a symphony and it's going to sound like this. Like, you wouldn't necessarily predict.
Exactly, yeah. And I think there's many fields like that, that have become so complex and so dynamical that we need to start applying some of these other tools and start becoming slightly more comfortable with the idea that we don't necessarily always understand how the answers are arrived at when you apply an algorithm.
Yeah, that makes me think of Isaac Held's idea about the hierarchical modeling idea. You know, he's a big fan, and I am too, of this approach where you start with the simplest model you can think of. You know, you write something down with just pencil and paper to try to capture the very basic elements of the system you're working with. And then you see what happens when you add layers of complexity. Mm-hmm. And so machine learning, I kind of think, can be part of that hierarchy, at least in terms of how you analyze those differences and you analyze what happens, you know, when you add and take away different sources of complexity. It's orthogonal. I keep using that word, but yeah,
it's a different approach, and it should by no means replace what we're currently doing. And it shouldn't replace going out and making physical observations of the real world. But
yeah.
It can be a real tool. And because it is such an unexplored space, I think there's a lot of really exciting science to do. And you know, it should be every scientist's great dream, right? Is to suddenly have a new space in their field open up that no one else is in, and you know, having the opportunity to go and do that.
And then a gold rush occurs,
yeah,
and everyone rushes.
I mean, but that does benefit people. If there's actually genuinely stuff to be learned here, then that's great for everyone, right?
Yeah, absolutely. It is, yeah, for sure. So I like to talk about creativity a little bit, and like, how do you approach that? Because I think that's an aspect of science that maybe isn't obvious from the outside, right? Because we kind of, there's a reputation that scientists are very, you know, analytical, very data driven, and all that is true. But in the face of all of that data, you have to have some creative impulse or some creative sense of how to approach that. Like, you have to have some intuition this might be interesting.
We do make things. We do produce something. We produce new knowledge and
yeah.
new understanding, and that is essentially the act of creating.
Yeah,
something.
Definitely.
And ideally, it's just going to be plugged into our global consciousness of knowledge, and the boundaries of what people know about the universe we live in gets pushed back very slightly, and it's a creative act doing that.
Definitely. What do you do like for yourself to kind of keep that, you know, alive, that creativity? What do you do for your inspiration and things?
That's hard. What inspires you? I think it's really the desire to know. Like, when I was a kid, I was always asking why, right? And I think this is a characteristic of many scientists. It's always asking why and wanting to know stuff. I wanted to be the one who knew stuff.
Yeah.
And so when we, you know, in our weekly library visit in the school library, I was always having to be dragged out of the nonfiction section because I was getting books out of there. And it was books about planes and history and how stuff works and that sort of thing, because I always wanted to know.
Yeah.
And so really it's quite privileged to be the first person to know this stuff. It might be very esoteric. It might be, you know, the warming of the upper circumpolar deep, or the upper circumpolar deep water in these particular areas of the Southern Ocean is warming. But I'm still the first one to know.
That's right. There's such a feeling with, I want to say something to kind of plug into that and relate to that. And that, so I did this math master's degree, and as part of that work, I produced a couple of new proofs. Nobody's ever going to care about those proofs. It's not like relevant to anything really, right? But I felt it was cool to have that feeling of like, oh, I made these proofs that nobody's done before. Nobody's looked at this particular system in this particular way and has arrived at that new bit of knowledge. You know, it's nothing's going to come of it. It's just, but it's cool. So I think having just that curiosity. And that's something other, like Lynn Talley was talking about that as well last week, about having that basic curiosity. Mm. Never stop asking questions. Like, just let yourself ask those questions and let yourself keep wondering, you know, why things work the way they do.
Yeah, absolutely. Asking questions. And so that's something I quite enjoy doing when I go on a voyage, because, you know, as principal scientific officer, particularly on a multidisciplinary voyage, there's a lot of people doing stuff that you have very little knowledge about. I'm not a biogeochemist. I don't know a lot about how chemistry, like the last time I did proper, you know, dunking various chemicals into one another and burning, setting things on fire, was back in year 12 when I was 16. So I like to go into labs where they're working and just ask them what they're doing and see how they do it and find out more about the area of science that, you know, normally I'm trying to facilitate happening as the PSO, but I know very little about. I'm just curious.
There's a balance to be struck there, right? Because you've got that curiosity, but you also have practical kind of life and funding demands.
Yeah.
And I think it's probably scary how easy it is to let all of those life demands and the kind of funding pressures and administrative stuff like we were talking about. It's kind of scary how easy it could be for all of that to take over and for you to not give yourself enough space to be creative.
Yeah,
and enough room to be creative.
I have to admit, some of my motivation in going asking what they're doing is trying to find out if they have some horrendous chemical that's going to blow a hole in the side of the ship. But yeah, you're right. Particularly as you become more senior in the field and people give you more responsibilities and logistics and organizing and supervising, then yeah, you can feel some of that wonder getting crushed, or the time that you would have otherwise taken to say, hey, I wonder if this... Yeah, I wonder if this is worth looking at. And then the time you might have spent just messing around in MATLAB or Python exploring some data, you tend not to do that as much because you realize that as well as running these things, you need to produce your science, and that means doing papers that are going to be, you know, payoff papers that you know is research that needs to be done, is interesting, and you have the story there, rather than maybe just saying, oh, this is an interesting little blip, maybe I should explore that some more. So that does tend to suffer. On the other hand, that's where the ideas for PhDs come from, right? So you can have students do that. You can say, hey, there's this really interesting piece of data. I haven't had time to explore it. Here's a concept I think is interesting and has legs, but, you know, I don't have time to do it. And so it was something I stressed about a lot when I was a PhD student, is that I didn't have those ideas. And that was simply a function of me not being really familiar with the space. And I worried that there was maybe something wrong with me as a scientist, that I wasn't coming up with these crazy ideas that needed exploring and was leading to great research. And now I find I have so many of those, not necessarily great ideas, but there are all these inklings of ideas that should be pursued or could be pursued in some way, that I don't have time to chase them all. And that's just, I think, just part of maturing as a scientist.
I think it's really valuable to put that out there. I think that's a super common experience.
You
don't have a ton of ideas when you first start out, precisely because you're not plugged into that world yet and you don't know the landscape. But once you start to get a feel of the landscape, you can start to see, well, it might look nice if I build a shed over there, or if I build a castle over there, you know, and if I plant some trees along this direction. You start to get a feel for that. But when you just show up, you know, you've kind of jumped out of a plane and landed in the landscape of academia. You don't know, oh, well, why is that cactus there? And why is this, you know, why have things been planted the way that they've already been planted? And I don't know what the plants are in my tortured metaphor, but I think, you know, you think you know what I'm trying to get at with that sense of, yeah.
But creativity is the essence of what we do.
Yeah.
And I think scientists, it's a bad rep that we have. It's not necessarily true. I mean, I know that you play bass, for example, or guitar, bass?
Both, yeah.
Bass, yeah. So you get twice as creative.
And you draw.
I used to. I certainly, as a kid, spent all my time drawing. Maybe the scientific side of it was that I wanted to draw things that were real. I wasn't a very abstract artist, but I really enjoyed drawing. And I sang a lot as well. I played music when I was younger, and even during my PhD, my time in Hobart, I sang as part of a barbershop choir and quartet. I guess that's some of that creativity has had to take a sidestep now that things are more busy, so I don't sing anymore.
Yeah.
Not to public. and I don't get to draw or paint nearly as much as I'd like.
Mm.
I still get to come to work and do something creative. So I guess we should be happy that this happens to everyone, right? You have families and things, but we still have a job where we're allowed to be creative and have that freedom to some extent set our own projects.
Yeah, that is a privilege, right? You got any recordings of those barbershop quartet?
if you carefully Google Deep South, you'll see us. In YouTube. I'm trying to remember what was probably the Australian barbershop convention. Barbershop's a weird form of singing in that it's actually competitive, and you have like these really amazingly. I'm always impressed at the judges how precisely they can rank. You have three or four judges listening to a song, and they give you a score out of 100 on various technical and artistic elements. And they always nail it with each other to within 1 or 2 points out of 100.
Really?
Yeah. And, at a competitive level, you can get scores somewhere between 70 and 95 or something, depending on how good people are.
So there's a very specific scoring system that...
Yeah, and I have no idea how they do it. I sang because I enjoyed it, not because I was good at it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a really, really nice social atmosphere. I mean, that's where barbershop came from, right? It was men singing in barbershops in a men's space.
You know, I'm embarrassed to admit I've literally never thought of that, despite the name is Barbershop Quartet. Yeah. It just isn't a thought that... that's funny.
And I hasten to add that barbershop isn't inherently sexist. It's the matter of blending voices so that four voices sound like one person singing five notes. And you can do that with women as well, but having a man's voice or a woman's voice mixed in with the group sort of messes with that tone. So you need to have... ideally, people who sound as similar as possible to one another
in the
timbre of their voice.
Because it should almost, I guess what you're saying is it should sound like you're playing on one instrument. You're playing different notes on one instrument, right? That they have a similar timbre. Well, that was fun. This was fun. Do anything else you want to talk about?
This was very free-ranging. This was fun. I had no idea what to expect. It was nice to talk.
I'm glad.
I have to... look into my alcoholism. I have to do something about a bottle of vodka on my desk.
There's some numbers you can call.
Yeah.
The UK has very good support for that, I think. So we can get you to the NHS and...
I'm glad the seething rage I feel inside isn't really becoming apparent just yet.
You're hiding it so well. It's just right under the surface. If you look in his eyes... he's just right. I'm starting to see it just a little bit. I literally don't know what your buttons are, so I wouldn't know what buttons to push. And that's a good thing. Like, so don't, in terms of making you mad. I wouldn't want to find out.
I get it all out in the football field.
Do you play a lot? Do you do that a lot still?
So I used to play underwater hockey in Hobart really competitively. So there was my highest sporting achievement back when I was 21. And I didn't realise it then, but I'd peaked. And I was I played for Australia in underwater hockey.
Yeah?
And we won.
So underwater hockey, played for Australia. So that sounds like it's on a national, or what is national level? Or
So it sounded better than it actually was. Underwater hockey is a niche sport,
as you
might guess from the name. But for no apparent reason, it was big in Hobart. I don't know how it happened. It was like an accident of geography and people, but it was a big sport there. And there was a tri-nations competition between Australia and New Zealand and South Africa, and it was hosted in Hobart. And it's not a professional sport, so it was much, much easier to make the squad if you happen to live in Hobart already.
So there was it's a niche sport, so if you're in and you have some skill, you can go far.
You happen to live there, yeah. I got to play for Australia, that was cool. It's all been downhill since then. It's just very casual, very I never really played cricket or Australian football in Australia, mostly because people there are too good at those sports. But since coming to the UK, there's a very nice casual level of cricket and a nice casual level of Australian football, which I do here just to, you know, hang on to my roots.
Yeah. Nice. Well, thanks, Andrew.
Well, thanks a lot, Dan. It's been really enjoyable.
I'm glad.
Cool.
There you have it. My conversation with Andrew Myers. I hope you enjoyed that. I wanted to finish this story about Trevor McDougall and him threatening to castrate me. So where that story ended up, it's kind of anticlimactic, so I just published a correction, basically. It took me all of, 10 minutes to remake the figure using the combination of stream function and density that Trevor suggested. And I just sent it off to the journal, and they said, okay, fine, they replaced the figure, so now when you download this paper on Modewater from 2016 of ours, it's got the correct figure. Maybe that's an unnecessary detail for a podcast, but I just kind of wanted to tell you that we've resolved the situation. That's all fixed. I also wanted to say that on the last podcast, I mispronounced Nancy Bompey's last name. Sorry about that, Nancy. I had never heard anybody say her last name before, and I realized it when I listened to her podcast, her third pod from the sun, part of the AGU series of podcasts, which if you haven't heard that, give that a listen. Well worth your time. Short, focused, good science conversations. So I hope you enjoyed this, and there you go. See you later.
The podcast you just heard was recorded with Anchor. If you want to make your own, download the Android or iOS app completely free from anchor.fm/podcast. That's anchor.fm/podcast.